It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
I've been living for since 1893. I shouldn't have lived without the past. Everybody don't know how to do it. Oh, always listen to me when I start to talk. The old times. So I love to listen because I'm the oldest one in Unalakleet.
Doris Hackettag, Unalakleet senior citizen, likes to talk about the past. Times before the Eskimo village in Norton Sound became a popular stop for miners rushing dogs and walking up the trail over the portage in the Yukon River, seeking the gold fields of Nome. Times when the community served as a trading center for Eskimos from St. Michael to the south, King Island to the west, and Kayakon Athabascan Indians northeast over the portage from Kaltag. Today, there is still trade between Kaltag and Unalakleet, but dog teams tend to pull into the village only once a year during the running of the Iditarod race.
Dogs seem to run towards the setting sun, 1,000 miles to Nome. Through wind and snow and overflow, men and dogs race on against trail and time and Arctic climb. It's not for the weak and brave. Through the wilderness to find the best on the Iditarod Trail.
The Iditarod Trail takes its name from the town 300 miles above the junction of the Tanana and Anoka Rivers that became the transportation and trade center for Alaska's last major gold rush. Between 1911 and 1925, hundreds of people made their way to the Iditarod mining district to Flask, Discovery, and Dykeman. But well before that time, more than 2,000 miles of trails were from south central Alaska from Seward to Nome on the Seward Peninsula were used for carrying mail. And before that, in Doris Hackettag's youth in the time of her ancestors, what we now know as the Iditarod Trail was used for commerce and for war. In this conversation in Unalakleet with Roger McPherson, she remembers times of miners and traders.
First, when people are coming after that big strike, Iditarod strike, lots and lots of people. That first tried their gold, they had from Unalakleet. And one old man from Shaktulik tribe, they always go hunt summertime, walking, hunting caribou. And then they get killed caribou, they drive them, half drive them, and they pack them home to their children. And then this man got tired, so on the ridge, going to Shaktulik, he stopped up there on top and see the whole sea down there, see how beautiful the sea is down there. He enjoyed it. Without looking, he lets his finger touch lots of things. And while he's doing that, that rock is a little bit different. So he picks it up and sees. It's a kind of not too red one, not too bright one, but it's kind of some kind of rock. My goodness, look at that, what I found. And he took another rock, tried to break it, it never broke. My goodness, and then he put it on top of some rocks and told the people that he found the rock up on that ridge. He tried to break it, he tried to break. Years after, doctor came and said, inspect, and they said, this is Alaska gold. They showed these Eskimos. These are Alaska gold. Alaska is very rich. And he thought of that thing up there. And he go up there and look for it and never find it. He don't know where it is. It's a good piece.
You see those miners camping here then?
No miners. Down here, maybe two or three. The youth people I remember come from King Island. Summertime, you know, for trading something, and they always pick that tent down there in the evening. They dance up here.
What did the King Island people bring with them?
Skins. Yeah. And these Eskimos from here, they take what little they have to.
When the Iditarod was first, when the first strike happened, did you see more Gusaks?
Not many Gusaks. Iditarod first strike, we were in Blueberry Creek, we was up there. And these Gusaks. They said, Gusak, come in. I like to see what Gusak look like. And so I look for them. No different than Eskimo, only the talk is different.
Was he a miner?
Yeah. Minak. Gusak is a white man. Minak is a miner. Good miner. That's how we call those Gusak Minak. We saw people think they all go look for, they all go for gold, every one of them. So we always call them Minak. Minak. That means look for, person who look for gold, Minak.
The golden band are here. The golden band.
The Indian village of Cowtag is on the Yukon River, over the hill to Unalakleet. In Cowtag, Goodwin Semekin talks with Roger McPherson about trading in the past and the present, about carrying mail over the portage, and early days in the village 90 miles from Unalakleet.
Well, every time my mother and my dad used to go over there, mostly used to go over there for seed oil or white rubber, because my mother was raised on a seat like that, and she knew that wanted without any seed oil or a white rubber or some Eskimo food, you know, like a fish. Of course, different kind of fish that they're getting, which they don't get on Yukon. You know, some town cod and what they call a humpback fish. A town cod, really, because I really like that town cod. Even though I was grow for it, it still tastes good for me, you know. So my mother used to go out there, and some of them used to buy it. The people just give it to her. Because they know her, you know. Well, if I go out there right now, if I go out there to my friends, especially that one friend I got there, he gave me all the town cards I want right now free, you know. I was over there this year in the next 80s, in December, you know. And then I went and visited one of my friends there. And he told me, good thing you want some town cards? I said, yeah. And you go out there to my cash and hug yourself. Take whatever you want. Well, I cannot do that. I tell you, you got to give me some. I told him not too much, though, because he was quite a bit low. We went over there by train, you know. He said, we're quite a bit low, so we done some shopping, and we're going to come back. They brought in a 100-pound sack full. Well, I didn't want to turn it down. I like the fish. So I said, well, I'll tell you this. I said, well, I'll tell you this. Over the years that I went to the industry, and these things I said, this thing is seed oil, you know. Every time I go out there, they give me a jar full of seed oil, or whatever they got. You know, they got some pickled fish. They even give me that, you know. They even give me a whole seed sometimes, you know. If I ask them for seed, they just give it to me. I try to buy something, but they don't want to sell it to me. They want to give it to me. If I go to the center, I got the ring of food.
Goodwin's father used to cross the portage too.
Well, my dad used to have, when 17 to 20 knots all the time, and it was for carrying knives. Okay, at the beginning of the year when you start to make service, we used to take about 11 or 12 feet at all times. Kingdom dogs kind of tired out, you know. And then later on you started to use it much more, about 17 or 20 dogs. You know. But in those days there used to be quite a bit mail going by, because that's only the place the mail comes from the coast and both ways to south and north rim of the coast. The mail used to come through there. All the first class mail and the second class mail used to go through, you know. Therefore, sometimes you would see between 600 to 900 pounds, you know, if you don't have enough room, just that way. So, I think on the pictures, you know how they load up donkeys or camel, you know, the statues behind on the side. The mail ship used to be like that, and remember when I was a kid.
Did you find it was a G-pole?
A G-pole was a stick attached to the side of the sled in front.
My dad would be on the G-pole all the time. Mm-hmm. Because with that much load, you cannot handle it from the handlebar. Mm-hmm. So you got to be on the G-pole in order to handle that thick of a load.
Were there any cabins along that trail from Caltech to Yuma Creek?
There was a mail cabin, and the mail cabins used to be one out here at 10 miles and one at 22 miles, and then one at 40 miles. What they call 10 mile cabin, even though it's 40 miles, called 10 mile cabin. Okay, there was another one at 12, that old woman, I was just only at 10 miles from now. In the cabin I'm talking about. So there was another one at Whaleback. That was the last one, Whaleback. It was only 22 or 25 miles from the industry. And those cabins, they were provided by the road commissioner. They called it road commissioner that time, the first picture of the city. But the main thing is that you don't haul your own wood today. And if the guy that got the mail contract, like William got the mail contract for this area now, in the same way it's been like that for years. So the guy just used to get the mail contract, used to send somebody out there in the beginning of the fall and then pick up the wood, provide the volume, and pick the rest for the winter use. Okay, sometimes if you run out of wood, and it or some wood there, a couple, three quarts of wood, and then the cabin. So all the meantime do is just go back and forth and cut some wood, whatever they need. But they always make sure that next mail, they used to be sure and just carry mail from there, out on the forest. They always make sure that they've got enough wood there for the next mail carry that comes in, 10 minutes, 30 minutes. But so in case something emergency happens, you know, just like this, other mail carry that's just maybe half frozen or that's hurt, you know, you don't have to do all that magic. I do just put on the stove and start the fire. Mm. And you have telephone in every place too. And a telegraph wire. But that telegraph wire was running from St. Michael all the way to Canada. And I think some of the telegraph wires that are out there, there's some quite a bit out there from St. Michael.
I'm in the town down to the town, down across the hill.
The Caltag Yumila Creek Portage is considered one of the prettiest parts of the Iditarod Trail by Marcus. 90 miles of ongoing history in a more than 1,000-mile race. A bridge between Indians and Eskimos, between natives and miners, a place for contact and change. You've heard Goodwin Stemmickin of Caltag and Sora Kakutag of Yumila Creek. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles. Portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan. Lewis Landing, Old Woman, Inoko, names of towns, roadhouses, and way stations that are part of the history of the Iditarod Trail, a history that goes back well before recorded time, to the time that Alaska Natives forged pathways along rivers and creeks, over mountain passes along the coast, to establish trade routes to exchange goods and partners, and occasionally to war. Later, French, Canadian, German, English, and Russian explorers would follow these same routes and forge new ones in their efforts to open the rich territory for more trade, for telegraph lines, for gold. In those times before airplanes came north, these routes and other trails were used to carry mail, and in 1925 in the Sierra Run snow, to carry medication to a community under siege. Use of the Iditarod Trail has been revitalized in the last decade with the annual 1,049-mile Anchorage to Nome Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Aloysius Aldemasi of Galena was born in 1904, just a few years before the town of Iditarod became the trade and supply center for the Iditarod Inoko Mining District. In an interview with Roger McPherson, he remembers the early days of Iditarod.
The Iditarod, as far as I remember, I was 4 years old that I heard Iditarod was struck around 1908, I think. 1908. And then I seen a mail carrier they called Bob Griffiths, you know, that used to cross across the country to Caltech. And when Caltech boys was telling me that all that trail over to Rick Shaw into this Caltech and over into Overwise. The trail is all growth in, you know, just literally a moment later when I left last spring, I felt that voice was telling me about the trail. As I remember Bob Griffiths used to come in about once a month from over Inoko around this target and into Iditarod, I think it was. College mail into Nulato. Nulato, there was a post office in there, you know. He used to come in once a month and used to stay at the William Dahlquist root house in Nulato. Yeah, right under the mouth of the sluice at the bluff of the cemetery down there, Nulato, you know. Yeah. They call that Muckrock Field. A fella, Jack Hens, used to be there from Junior Creek, you know, long years ago. Came in around in 1914, I think, from Junior Creek. And Eskimos, we used to call him Muckrock Jack, you know, down Junior Creek, a nickname. And his real name was Jack Hent. And he lived down there until around 1918. He started to work on Seattle number 3 as a fireman. And then he planned to go out to the States, you know, for good, you know. Now, he got caught on that safari that sunk around Juneau with Jack Green, a brother of George Green, the George Green, Captain George Green, that used to be captain of the Reliance of Keokuk River, and Jack Green used to be captain to the draw of White Horse from Dawson. To the draw of White Horse, you know. And sometimes, you know, the Yukon, John Willie used to come down. Yeah, I think at the Yukon and there was Alaska and Axel, I knew of the A-Wine Company, Canadian boats, you know, from Dawson, you know. But now, the fire, you know, there was a wireless station in the latter, was living in the latter then in 1984, you know. And we heard the news, you know, there, from wireless station there. Old Father Ross used to go back there every evening, you know. He was well liked, you know, by the signal corps, you know, operators, you know. And the radio was coming on then, little by little, you know. You know. And when I left all across in 1917, we had radio station already. And in 1922, they had the first radio station in Ruby. Yeah. 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 Before, it used to be telegraph lines. We used to operate with codes, you know, signal, you know.
Can you tell me also about the early Lewis Landing and how it got started there?
It got started in 1914 when Ivan Rod was struck, you know, and from on down from Dawson Yukon territory on down up the Yukon miners that lived around Circle and all them places, you know, like as far as Rampart and stuff like that, you know. They came down with horses, you know, and some came into Nulato across the Cayo flat across Nulato into Cayo Range and get on the right side of Mud River to go into Agin Rock, you know. I've seen horses going down that way too, you know. Yeah. And so this Lewis, you know, he was a smart man, you know, among us. He had a trading store, you know. And now, he was well liked by some Indian nationality people, you know. He was well liked. So he got a contract, you know, to build road up just Lewis Landing, you know, and make straight cross country road over to South Fork Inoko. When they get over into South Fork Inoko, they go on down Inoko River and then they get around that Cooper Mountain, you know, that Ivy Draught River draws in over that way, you know. And yeah, that's where they used to go to Ophir too, you know. Yeah. In those days. So they wanted to make a shortcut for the miners, you know, that traveling, you know, with dog team and horses, and give a shortcut. And they picked out experimental fellows like Old Man Jimmy from Old Loudon, Old Man Charlie, and Old Man Bucky, and a fellow they called Brother Malin Root. Or there was a lot of young fellows in between St. Louis Landing and Loudon. They cut the trail over, you know, they knew the country, you know. The white nationality, you know, that nobody's making trail because they didn't know where to cut trail over, straight over, you know, on that big loose landing trail, you know. And so they had a 12-mile horse span from Des Loose Landing on the foot of the hill across, straight across. It's past 8-mile slough that connects in from UK into the draw of Malwood's camp up here, you know. Yeah. And then from there on, there was another relief cabin in between the Yuki Fork and Left Fork. Yeah, you see, it was high place in there where there was a road house. They built road houses all along as they built the road at the same time along, you know. From there on, you know, they go on lower down and then cut over into the Ivy Rock River, you know, cross country, you know, over the hills, you know, into Ivy Rock, you know. Yeah. And that's the way they explored that, this Lewis Landing Trail.
Tell me about your own days when you used to carry mail. What years did you do that?
In 1921, on December 15th, I entered the double mail for Fred Milligan. Fred Milligan had contract for 8 years under entry company bid, and then the fellas on the Yukon River machine, see who's got a team, you know, bid in for every routine where they're going to carry mail, you know. The lowest bidder gets it, you know. And Milligan got it from 1913 to 21 for $8,000 a year, you see. And so I was 17 years old, yeah, 17 years old. The old man helped me in, you know, to make 13-foot baskets, you know, up to the end of the sand bluff there. There's all kinds of birds up there, nice birds, you know, on the hill, you know, up a part of the sand bluff, you know. And I helped the old man build 13-foot baskets that could handle 800-pound limit mail, you know. I had 16 dogs. I pulled 1,675 pounds to Caltech, and yeah, it took me 15 hours to make 40 miles. I had to put rope on my shoulders and pull with the dog and put my feet on the sled, and I helped them dogs, you know, come at 12 o'clock midnight. I was in Caltech. I couldn't unhook the last double edge slip, you know, the dogs holler. And I had the 2/4-inch cable tow line and a 4-strand of hard rope ahead. And I unsnapped the 8 dog's neck lines, you know. I couldn't my dogs, you know, to turn around my dogs around to pull up one set at a time. Oh, it took me about half an hour in there, you know, I didn't see anybody, you know, above Caltech, end of Caltech village down there, you know. Nobody around there. I golly them dogs, you know. I pulled that cable tow line there. It was just so tight, I just pulled it so much there. I was in good lifter too. I used my tricks to lift to get the flesh start like that. Yeah. Finally they started my horror and the dogs they start about. They just flopped down and just barely pull up the 1,675 pile off that bank hill at Caltech. 3 hours back when I got down to the very cavern, you know, at the dog barn there, isn't it?
Aloysius Al DeMasi of Galena, a pioneer of the Iditarod Trail. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
To a great extent, especially like going to AFN board meetings, you see the same faces like you saw 10 years ago. There has to be a change. There has to be more leaders coming into all of the different corporations, I think, because none of us are going to be around here that much longer.
The speaker, John Savitt, has been around since the early days of the land claim struggle. He served as president of both the Panama Chiefs Conference and Dayan Limited, and in the State House of Representatives. He is currently Dayan's chairman of the board and a state senator as well. Saffet, like most of the leaders of Native corporations, is still young, but sees a need for the development of new Native leadership. The Alaska Native Leadership Project, based in Anchorage, is trying to address that need. The project is part of the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program, which is a joint project of the Alaska Native Foundation and the University of Alaska. Frank Berry, who is originally from Haines, is the program's deputy director and heads the leadership project, now in its second year.
It's called a leadership training program, but in no way are we thinking that we're making leaders out of people. We're taking people that have sort of selected themselves for the program. They've gone through all of the application processes, and they feel they have potential for leadership. They feel that they want to get involved and that they want to do things for their people, their villages, and what have you. So they really are exhibiting potential, I would say.
Back in 71, 72, when studies were being done about the management needs for implementation of the corporate provision of the Act, there were a number of studies that said, hey, we haven't got enough people out here to do this. Why is it only in the last 2 years that something is being done?
Well, I think that has taken a number of years in order to figure out what the Act is about and possibly what Congress or the U.S. government had in mind when they did establish the Act. It's taken quite a jump, you might say, going from having nothing to suddenly overnight having 12 different regional corporations and all of these village corporations which needed to be established, and then a lot of the rules in the game, so to speak, not yet even defined. And so it's taken a number of years to figure out exactly what are the requirements to operate the corporations, and then therefore begin sort of lining up the talent that you need to run them. And so, yeah, it's taken a long time, but we're finally getting to the point now that we feel confident that we are doing a good job, that we have a good idea as to what the corporations can do, and therefore now we have great people who are coming forward and are selecting themselves to get involved.
So you're doing your leadership training in a different way than you would do for people of a different ethnic background?
Yeah, that's the whole idea. It's called an Alaska Native Leadership Program, so it's meant to reflect as much as possible the different backgrounds, the different cultures, the different heritage that people bring with them. We aren't trying to establish the program and then sort of fit the, make people fit into the program, but it's meant to be a flexible program, although there is a good portion of it that I find some inflexibility in that dealing with a group. I have to keep it the same so everybody can go through similar experiences, but we also deal with individual differences in that people come in with their own expectations, their own needs, their own interests, and we try to fulfill those expectations by providing internships and individual training programs for them in addition to the experiences that they're picking up as a group, as they go through the different training sessions with the group.
Can you give me an example of some of the different kinds of approaches and techniques you do?
It's sort of the basic idea that underlies the whole thing is participation. And nobody sits around and is lectured at or to. And different people from all around the country who are good at what they claim to be good at. And we've gotten into different things such as just running meetings. What are some of the different styles that meetings can be run? Used to be, I think, when corporations first started, everybody had the idea of Robert's Rules of Order, and that just doesn't always work, especially in some of your more traditional settings in the villages. So what we do is we're giving people the practice of facilitating meetings, which is really getting in the front of the room and actually helping the group to run their own meetings, dealing with problem-solving techniques, decision-making techniques, how people can go about running meetings effectively and accomplishing specific goals or points by the end. In addition to that, we're getting into, well, skill building activities, for instance, just in the communication area alone. We've done different things from interviewing techniques to active listening to observations to comparison of different leadership styles and presentations of materials and information and what have you.
In this conversation, we've been talking about Alaska Natives, like it's just one big amorphous body. Do you find that there are differences culturally among the groups in terms of leadership style?
Definitely. I'm no way an authority on this, but just from the two groups that I've been dealing with, in comparison from, I would almost call it a southeast style compared with a northwestern Alaskan style, which is, you have to take into consideration when you're having one of the students or participants who are from different areas of the state exactly what you're going to require them to do and how you may sort of evaluate them. I give them feedback on what they did accomplish, and this is really going to be getting all bungled up. But there are definitely different styles. I would say, without categorizing or labeling people, which I try to avoid doing, is the Southeast tends to be more assertive, more aggressive. You have your Nupiat culture, which tends to be a little bit quieter, more reserved, and sitting back and listening much more than you're going to find usually amongst the Southeastern, and to a large extent, generally amongst the interior Indians. As an example of differences.
This is that people in the program go into internships.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found any resistance to the leadership program, to the idea of training native leaders?
I have been surprised about how little resistance there has been. The first, the idea of, we first started with it in 78, and we didn't get the first program. Operating until 80, and during those intervening 2 years, I talked to a lot of people, and I never ran into really one negative comment. I had a couple maybe offhanded remarks about, how can you make leaders they're born, that type of a thing, and I would just come back with the responses that I'm really, not operating under the delusion that I can make anybody a leader that was trying to do that. We're just providing the environment for anybody to pick up necessary skills that they can apply in a leadership situation, whether it's a personal situation, whether it's a village situation, family situation, what have you. These are all skills that people will need somewhere down the road, or can use somewhere down the road in making decisions, settling conflict, just running things, organizing, planning. We're using a lot of the skills and a lot of the talent and ideas that have been around before, but have never been applied to Alaska Natives. And I've never been offered to Alaska Natives in a setting or structured in such a way that it is flexible time-wise, it's flexible in terms of the different skills we can offer when, it's flexible in terms of the variety of skills that they have, they can choose from, and they mean the participants have a lot of say in what they want to do. In other words, they bring with them, again, their ideas and their needs and their interests, and we try to take what we got identified so far as really usable skills and allowing them to choose as much as possible. We have to stay within budgets and time constraints and things, but to choose exactly what they want when. And so there's a lot of flexibility built into our system. We're not trying to sort of lay a philosophy, I don't know if that's the right word, on anybody, but what we're trying to do is that we have the participants who are involved in the program are as different as you can possibly find in Alaska in terms of variety of backgrounds. You have people who, you have women who are strictly housewives who are involved, but yet want to get involved more in their community and do things. We have men who are strictly subsistence hunters who are involved because they feel the great need that they want to get involved and see good things happening in their communities. We have guys who are gals, ladies who are presidents of village corporations. So we run the whole gamut of backgrounds as to who's involved, and it seems to work. And we don't seem to disenfranchise or to leave out any portion of the group as we sort of concentrate on another area. We try to incorporate as much of the culture as possible as we are constantly networking. The networking part is probably one of the most important parts of the program, because it's not only dealing with current Alaska Native leaders who are constantly meeting with the group at different times, but we're dealing with the traditional, the elders from the villages who we all bring in at many different times or whenever the opportunity arises.
Participants in the Alaska Native Leadership Project must be high school graduates and may arrange for university credit for their participation. The 11 students in the project's pilot group use their skills in a variety of ways.
We have one gal who has returned to school and is working on her master's degree in public administration to go back and work in a hospital as an administrator. We have a fellow who's doing an internship right now in Washington, D.C. with the Department of Interior Bureau of Land Management. We have another fellow who has took part in the summer exchange program, which was a group of American Indian Alaska Native young persons that went to Oslo for the summer, an 8-week exchange program over there. We had another young lady who took part in a 3-week program in Dallas, Texas. I think it was Dallas, I can't remember the place now, but it was dealing with the border health situation between the U.S. and Mexico, in which there was a lot of negotiations there between, the indigenous people of the area and the non-native people of the area down there, in terms of the health services that are required and necessary for that.
What I hear you saying then is that this leadership project isn't specifically to train leadership for Native corporations, but for any leadership role.
Exactly. I mean, leadership isn't found only in, or the need for leadership isn't found only in the regional corporations or the village corporations. There's all kinds of, I mean, whether you're talking school systems, whether you're talking, again, the corporations, or you're talking just within a village government of one kind or the other, a council, or you're talking of working in a hospital. You're talking even working with your family. Sometimes extended families can get to be quite large.
In visiting Native corporations, I'm impressed by one outstanding thing, the lack of women. Is your program going to address that in any way?
It's incredible that you brought that up. Last year we had 11 in the group, as I mentioned. 6 were men and 5 were women. This year we have 17 in the group. 11 are women and 6 are men. So I think we're addressing it, and I don't know if that's some sort of a an evaluation of the type of training we're putting together or the program itself, but it's something that I have to consider when it comes to next year advertising the program again. I don't know if it's the way I'm advertising the program or if it's just that the women are now Alaska Native women are in such a position that they can find themselves more opportunities, therefore they're seeking better training or more training, or what's going on. But yeah, we had this year in the over 50-some applicants for the program, it was 3-1 in favor of women applicants. And they are really anxious to improve their skills and to get involved. And there's some darn talented ladies, really are. Some darn talented Alaska Natives. Incredible.
Frank Berry, director of the Alaska Native Leadership Project. You can contact him at 411 West 4th, Anchorage, Alaska, 99501. I'm Terry Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.